Cass County, which is just east of Pottawatomie, to start SWIFI. And they asked Pott County to be involved because of the population, of course, in Council Bluffs and Omaha. We had to be integral in that SWIFI effort. In the fall of 2007, we did our asset mapping. In spring of 2008, we started our strategic plan. When we started out, we had about 50 people very interested. The second meeting was 30, and then we got it whittled down to about, you know, 6 or 10 people that were the regulars. And did the strategic plan, and in August of 2008, we passed resolution number 40, which appointed a food council. And it put, and we also put funding toward a local food coordinator. That money went to the RC&D. It was leveraged with some Leopold and Iowa West Foundation dollars. And I think by March of 2009, we had a local food coordinator on board. I want to talk about the benefits of a board-appointed food council. Is that I think when the Board of Supervisors get involved, people notice, and it gives a certain authority or gravitas, I guess, if that's the right word, to what you're trying to do as a community. And if the board's involved appointing a food council, people kind of sit up and take notice. And, of course, they're there to work on policy and make suggestions to the Board of Supervisors. And if somebody gets mad and leaves, and wants to quit the food council, the Board of Supervisors is always there to appoint another one. It will always be there. So what other reasons should counties be involved? I just went through the departments in the counties and tried to see how they are related to local foods. Of course, there's economic development, which Kim's going to talk a lot about, which is your recorder's office and your roads department. Emergency management. I'm just going to go through these real quick. Public safety. If you have any questions wondering how local foods connect to any of these, you can ask me later. Public health with obesity and diabetes. Mental health. In the last issue, May issue of the Iowa Counties magazine, Linda Kemp, who's a case management specialist for ISAC, had a nice article on mental health and nutrition. Conservation. Here's the one I really like. Conservation department. I suppose most departments in the state have a youth education component to them. And I think, you know, when the kids are out there studying nature, what is it they're actually studying? They're studying plants and animals, insects. Is any zoologist in here from Iowa State? I was a zoologist from Iowa State once. I got smart and started farming. Anyway, insects are classified by their mouth parts, by what they eat. And if you start taking a good look at nature, it's nothing but a very large, complicated food system. That's what this whole planet is a food system. If you ever look at the Seed Savers catalog out of Decorah, they have in the back a bunch of books on how to grow tomatoes and grow rhubarb and cooking books. But in the side panel, it has those popular books, Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver, Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, and down at the bottom is Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv about our how our youth are so disconnected from the natural world. And thinking gardening and community gardens can help reconnect kids to the natural world. Here's another story about your GIS department. Jack Dangerman is the president and director of ESRI, which is the company that writes pretty much all the programs for your GIS department. Jack Dangerman, way back in the 70s or 80s, was a computer programmer, and he wanted to write a GIS program and make a map of his backyard garden. So GIS started in a guy's backyard garden. I thought that was cool. And of course, your other departments is your planning and zoning department. We're talking about land use and policies for that land use. Because if you get more and more growers, small farmers out, how are she going to address those issues that come up? I'm about done, Ken. Don't sit down yet. So as you go through this, and I think maybe a lot of it you've already done, is to gather the partners of the community. Of course, in Pott County, we have Swiffy and the neighboring counties, and then we're making efforts over in the, across the river in Nebraska. You got your RCMD, ISU Extension, your hospitals and institutions, restaurants, growers, of course, schools, your faith community, food banks. Just started visiting with the Regional Workforce Investment Board, Iowa Workforce Development. Apparently the Department of Labor has figured out that farming is a job. So that, and then you get connected with your local foundations, of course, at home it's the Iowa West Foundation, other nonprofits. Now I noticed that as you bring all these partners together, not everybody's going to agree on how to do things or what your goals are or how to achieve those goals. Well, one thing you have to keep in mind is that there's this main big objective, and some of that minutia should not get in your way. I brought some handouts here of a nice article, and I don't know who wrote it. Somebody sent it to me, but I'll hand them out after I'm done yammering away here. But yeah, just you need to stay focused on what that main objective is. Let me talk about the supervisors a little bit. I've known Jane and Wayne for some time, and Jane knows everybody, and I'm sure Wayne knows a lot of people out there. They're very good connectors in your community, and that's one good place to go is to your board of supervisors, because they know people with all the other boards and commissions that you sit on. You can make those connections. I've called Jane, says, hey, do you know? And she says, yes, I'll give them a call. It was easy. Well, just the supervisors are connectors. Food is also a connector. It connects your families, it connects your community, and it connects you to the land, which I think is probably one of the most important of all. So in conclusion, there's no mandate on doing this. There's no blueprint. There's no right way, no wrong way. You're totally free to do however you want as a community, and it'll be fun, but most of all, most importantly of all, I think it's going to taste really, really good. So, just kind of like those rafts out here. Other than Berkeley, my son goes to school in Berkeley. He was out there. Of course, they have an advantage because of their longer growing season, but all of that food in those restaurants were sourced locally, and you know, it's not like eating in Council Bluffs. It was really good. So, I'll quit now. I've put in my 5 minutes. Or did I do 10? I want to, like I said before, I followed 10-meter route. I think this is about the fourth or fifth time that I've been on the dais with him. And I really enjoy him. He's done a lot of good work across the country, and I think you're going to enjoy what he has to say. He's been doing this for a number of years. He didn't tell me exactly how many. He was very vague, and so he's good at it. So. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming.
Okay, can you hear me in the back of the room? Okay, good. Well, it's really a pleasure to be here. This is, I think, a seventh or eighth region in Iowa I've had a chance to study. And it's always fun to follow Mel because he does such a great job of making the right stuff happen in his county, and then being able to connect with a variety of folks around the country to really show exactly why that's important. So it's a real pleasure on lots of levels. One thing that Mel was wrong about is that people don't always enjoy my speech, at least the first 20 minutes, because some of the news I have about the food economy is frankly discouraging, and I'm going to just try to do that as honestly as I can, not because I want to frustrate anybody in the room, but there is some news that's difficult to take in. My feeling is if we look at it very honestly and just talk about it honestly, we can actually find a way out of it. And if we hold back from looking at the whole story of what's happening, we often recreate the very same problems we're trying to solve in a new form later on. So I think it's really kind of important to look at some of the bad news as well as the good. But I promise what I will do is, first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about why I think food is a very cool thing to be working on at this time in this country. Secondly, I will show some new data for Story County that's just been done this summer for the county itself to really look at the food economy of this area. And then finally, I'm going to show you some of the things that I get most excited about. I get to travel around the country visiting people who are doing just amazingly dynamic things with food. And I'll show you some of the harvest of what of my travels, which I think will give you a sense of what the fun part of this is and the hopeful part of this story really will be. These are the regions that I've had the pleasure to study so far. As you can see, a cluster of activity here in Iowa, quite a bit in Minnesota, quite a bit in New Mexico, Arizona, Oregon, Washington, California. And this word has all spread for the last 10 years by word of mouth. No funder has made this happen. This is because people have liked the work and have spread the word. Leopold Center has been a great ally, so has the University of Minnesota's regional partnerships. But the fact it spread so widely is really due to the Food Security Coalition and people just calling up the phone and saying, this is worth looking at. A lot of what drives me to do the work I do is that we tend to get fall into a mistake in the United States where we think about food as, especially when we look at this agricultural data we have. We have phenomenal data resources in America. Most countries would be so thrilled to have the numbers we have. Yet we think of agriculture as being a matter of farms and commodities, when in fact it's a much richer story than that. We have real people who work in the fields, real people who drive tractors, real people who eat. And it's harder to tell their stories because we don't have hard, fast numbers the way we do when we can count the number of soybeans we produce. But those stories are equally important. And I'm trying to use data sets that were sort of designed to look at commodities and farms and to think about the people behind that story in as rich a way as I can. As Mel said, it's a very, you know, a very complicated food system. If you look at it from the perspective of communities, you see different things and you understand different things need to happen than if you simply look at it from the perspective of how many farms we have and how many commodities do we produce. With the Leopold Center in 2007, I had the privilege of being a group writing a regional food planning guide, which I really like as a way to get kind of introduce yourselves to what are the questions you'd have to address if you wanted to write a food plan for Story County. We puzzled over what should a food system accomplish. And we said, we told ourselves it really clearly wasn't simply a matter of how many big farms there were or how profitable those farms were. Something else had to be our measure of success. And we finally came up with a fairly, what we hope is a complex enough and simple enough definition. In our communities, we'd like to see our food system build health, wealth, connection, and capacity. Health is pretty obvious. Nutrition is so close to our ability to be healthy people, to have balanced diets, balanced lives. If we don't have those fundamental nutrition elements straight, we're all in a lot of trouble. Wealth is something that the present food system builds, but usually for some people at the expense of others. Especially rural communities in general have not nearly harvested enough wealth for the work they've done in the last several decades. And so we like to think about a food system that really is better at rewarding producers, better at rewarding rural communities. Connection is important because food is really how we connect with each other. When I serve a holiday meal, I'm serving the foods my great-grandparents would have served because that's how I say to people, this is where I belong, this is who my people are. Those connections are so clear. If someone visits me, I'm going to feed them if I can because that's what hospitality is about. Food should really be about building those connections. We've lost that ability in many ways. And finally, it should be about building capacity, too. I look at my family 100 years ago, and people knew far more about food. My great-grandmother knew how to cook for 12 people on a wood stove every Sunday afternoon for a festive dinner, doing phenomenal cooking that you can't even find anymore under terms that will really be very difficult for me to negotiate. People knew intuitively how to keep meat separate from vegetables. They knew how to keep some of the diseases from plaguing us because everyone had a contact with a farm, with food, and knew what safety was. Because we've gotten used to convenience and packaging, we've in many ways become dumber about our food supply. What I will argue today, and I don't have quite time to prove all this point, but I would argue that our food system as we have it now fails on all four of these counts. It's not building the health outcomes we deserve. We'll see that in Story County later. It's building wealth badly for some at the expense of others. It's separating us from each other, and it's also making us dumber about food. And all of those represent both problems, but also opportunities we have to build a food system from Story County that would actually accomplish these goals for ourselves. The key economic insight that I find wherever I go is that the food system is extremely efficient at taking financial resources out of our communities and putting them in the financial sector. And this is probably the hardest truth to talk about. Many people would like to pretend this isn't going on. And that's exactly the point we get in trouble, because people go on, charge ahead and say, let's solve the food issue, let's not look at the underlying economics, and they end up attaching themselves to systems that are taking wealth out of their communities and being frustrated in what they try to do. This, I think, is very key to recognize if we're going to move forward in a positive way. I've also been arguing for several years that building local food networks is the best way we have as a country to do our economic recovery. We've just spent $800 billion bailing out a banking system that we had to bail out to avoid instability. But that system itself was taking resources out of our communities and squandering them elsewhere. What is left to be done is the really hard work of getting down to our communities and really building food systems that build wealth, building economies that build wealth at the local level. We have to do that for ourselves. The banks won't do it for us. It's not the investment we made in stabilizing those banks was significant, but we have a lot of work and a lot of investment to do to really make the food systems of our future that will be based on an economy that's more fair and more able to produce community wealth. I also think that food is a very special topic. If Sally can't pay for food in the month of June, we don't just say, well, she's out of the market, she'll get it next month. We can't do that. We have to find a way for Sally to find good food. If she doesn't find it, she has health problems, perhaps. She may have other problems. Her children may have health problems. We have problems as counties and hospitals that we may have to pay medical expenses for what is lacking in that life. We have to find a way to include everybody in the food system. And if we don't do that, it's costly for all of us. Plus, food is the number two household expense. We spend $1 trillion a year as a society buying food. That's a lot of money. A lot of decisions we get to make, and how we make those decisions really dictates the future for ourselves and our grandchildren. We're going to learn some ways of doing business in a softer way than the greed we've experienced the last few years. We've seen what greed can do to undermine our way of life. We're going to have to learn some softer ways of doing economics that are lucrative, but also respectful of the environment, respectful of other people, in ways that we haven't been very good at for several decades. I also find some people waiting for the USDA to come up with a bunch of money to help us do local food system planning, and that would be a nice thing. I work for USDA part-time. I like them a lot. They have some really good people and good talents. At the same time, state and local governments currently spend $50 billion each year incentivizing what they call economic development, often not getting the return in jobs or tax base they would hope to get. They may offer an incentive to find a factory moves out of town as soon as the incentives are gone. They may find a factory locating and then finding cheaper labor somewhere else. Or they may also find that the jobs never really quite get created, or that the promises are bigger than the reality. My argument is that state and local governments could spend this $50 billion building a new food economy, and that would be the best single investment I can think of in promoting economic recovery. We don't need to get a new bill through Congress to do this. We need to spend money we're already spending in smarter ways. And once we do that, that will spill over into how we can do windmills and widgets and manufacturing. That's, I think, where we're going to start the recovery we all deserve, and we can start it now with our own resources. Finally, I'd just like to add that for me, local is a shorthand. When I say local foods, people seem to intuitively understand what I'm trying to get at, but I also would not argue that we should build a wall around Story County and say that all the food that everybody eats here should be totally raised within this county. I don't think that's wise or practical. I also would just soon be able to have the right to say, buy coffee from Guatemala if I feel like I want to have coffee and if I can afford to buy it. And if I buy coffee through a cooperative that's promising fair trade for the workers, that's shade-grown coffee, I can actually have some sense of localism about that exchange, because I'm actually able to shape that discussion by buying through my cooperative and saying we'd like to buy high-quality products that we feel good about. That's local in the sense I have a community relationship around that trade, which I don't get if I simply buy a box of coffee and put it into a machine. My argument is that I would like a food system that's actually community-based. And if that's community-based in a good way, it will be good for our locales. We'll have a stronger local economy in Story County. We'll also have stronger social connectivity here. It'll be full of businesses that do very well at the bottom line, but also do well at improving social and environmental goals at the same time. So when I use local food, I'm really kind of talking about it for this broader sense that let's build commerce that's really focused on relationships, that's focused on community building, as well as making good money. So with that in mind, let me show you a few facts about Story County itself. I know you know where the county is, but I had to put a map in just to kind of locate myself here. 86,000 residents who earn $3 billion of income each year. Already we've started talking about the fact that consumers here have considerable spending power, and how they spend their dollars each year creates one future or another, depending on those choices. $3 billion is not trivial. It's a lot of clout that you get to exercise day to day as you go to the store. The Story County population, this maroon line, has risen faster than the population of Iowa as a whole over the last 40 years. Clearly a sign that some people have been leaving the countryside to come to the urban areas such as Des Moines and Ames and perhaps Nevada. Personal income data, unfortunately, I only have until 2000, but it will show you that by far the largest job generator in the county is government jobs, which in this case includes education jobs at Iowa State, I believe. By far the biggest sector is that employment. The next is interest, dividend, and rent. So that's people making money by having capital property like savings accounts that give pay interest, or owning property that they can collect rental. The third largest source of income is services, and after that, manufacturing. And that rising manufacturing sector is, again, is a sign of some financial strength in Story County. But good signs of growth, good signs of diversity in where people make their income. If you look more closely, however, at the food-related industries in Story County from 1969 to 2000, you'll see the grocery sector stayed about the same for the last 40 years. Not much more personal income earned by workers in that industry now than in 1969. Sales in eating and drinking establishments have risen steadily, and food manufacturing has risen since 1986. Yet farm income has been sort of falling away at the same time. It's of some concern to have rising restaurant sales, rising manufacturing that's not tied to farm income for farmers in this county. Building those connections so that the income that's already being earned really builds more local wealth would be a terrific local development strategy. A little shadow side of the second income story is that more than one of every four people in the county earns less than the poverty level at which children qualify for free and reduced school lunch. As I go through farm country around the country, I'm increasingly finding puzzled faces when I puzzle with people, how can it be that in farm country, more than one quarter of the population is not sure how to eat a $2.50 lunch at school? How can that be in farm country? How can we let ourselves be that far from a sort of healthier food economy? One of every 10 Iowa residents is not insured, which means their needs for food are all the more dire, because food would be the best way you have of retaining health if you don't have the money to pay for doctors or hospital coverage. 64% of Iowans are overweight or obese, which is just less than the national average. 4 of every 5 Iowa residents report that they eat less than 5 fruits and vegetables a day, which is the minimum amount nutritionists say we should be eating for having healthier outcomes, including lower cancer rates. And the estimated costs for treating diabetes in Story County alone are $50 million per year. And to the extent that people are uninsured or going to a hospital without adequate coverage, those are costs that the county bears through welfare programs, or the hospitals bear by paying for patients who are not paying their own way. So some very tangible costs to the system we have now: bad health outcomes, imbalanced eating, and some real costs that counties bear because of the way we currently eat in our food system today. To look more carefully at farms, a little over 1,000 farms in the county, average size is just about the same as the Iowa average as a whole. One-third of the farms sell less than $10,000 a year, one-third sell more than $100,000 a year, and another third fall in the middle category. So a nice balanced slate of options. Any food planning you do that focuses only on the larger farms or only on the smaller farms will fail. It has to consider all of those three categories of farms alike, because each of them can make a different contribution to the future of food, whether by being experimental in a small plot and showing what resilient changing production can do, or by showing what can be done on a large scale with very efficient mechanization. They're all legitimate roles, but they will have very different approaches and needs. it'll become no surprise to any of you in this room to know that 3/4 of the income earned by farmers in 2007 was from selling grains, and another 13% from hogs and 9% from cattle and calves. You basically look at this pie chart and you realize that about 95 or 99% of what's sold in this county is devoted to the feed and care and sale of animals. Good thing to do, but notice how much more we know about what animals need for nutrition. We know their rations on an hourly basis. We know their protein balance on an hourly basis. We take phenomenal pains to raise livestock very well. All of those foods, however, are basically foods that have to be processed through some in this industry before we have a chance to eat them. The fruits and vegetables we could eat right off the farm are less than 1% of what's produced in this county. It would be remarkable, I think, if in the next 20 years we didn't get much smarter about human nutrition and much smarter about connecting what farmers produce to what we in this county need to eat. To see the same numbers, that's the same data as this pie chart, but it'll show you the, again, $170 million of sales of grains alone, $18 million of hogs, and $13 million of calves. The data looks funny because my computer didn't translate to this computer very well. Also, though, $54 million of data about sales in this county are not to be found in the farm census data. It looks like some of that is nursery and greenhouse sales. I think some of that may be some of the larger cattle or hog farms that really don't feel like they should report to USDA all their sales because they would like to feel some protection for privacy. I don't quite understand this because I think we all have a right to know exactly what is going into our food supply, how much is being raised, and how many acres. And what I found is that when data is suppressed for confidentiality, the competitors of that firm know exactly what they're doing anyway because they know each other's businesses pretty closely. And the people who are left in the dark are ourselves, county commissioners, planners who try to really think carefully about where we need to go. I would like to see us get back to a time when we all knew what was being produced and we could tell that data straight up front. That's very high even for Iowa. I was in a region in Idaho last week where it was similarly high, but what I found is that especially I've had trouble sort of tracking down hog production in Iowa simply because that's where it has been said we don't want to reveal how many hogs are in a barn or how many sales are made on a certain farm. The more you have a few farms in one county, the more the USDA says we won't report their sales because we don't want to reveal their any one single farm operation. Story County, despite having 0% fruit and vegetable production, is the number two fruit production producer in the state of Iowa. And again, this is a suggest that the secret to fruit production is to be close to markets like Ames and Des Moines. It also suggests we have a lot of opportunity in terms of raising fruits and vegetables in this region, that we have a great climate to raise. I'm sure many of you have seen the 1920s charts that Leopold Center did showing all the crops that used to be commercially grown in Iowa that have been lost. They're all things that can be easily grown here. We do eat them several times a week if we're able to, and we have quite good growing conditions. The county also ranks eighth in the state in the sale of grain. So a very significant county in terms of state agriculture, despite this the urban centers that are here. Only 9 farms are listed in the farm census as selling organic products, selling a total of $23,000. My guess is that this understates the amount of healthy farming here, both because USDA hasn't always been good about finding organic farms, and also because many farms just say, I don't want to be certified, but I don't want to use chemicals, and they sort of don't fall into the organic category in that way. 24 vegetable farms are listed, selling about $200,000 of product a year. A fairly small amount, but a healthy start towards the local vegetable industry. And what's really rising is the interest in people that people have for farmers and consumers to connect directly with each other. 10% rise each year in the number of farms, and about a 12% rise in the sales of direct sales of food items over the last 5 years alone. 57 farms selling direct to consumers out of 1,000, about 6% of the farms. $443,000 of sales, a 57% increase over a five-year period. This is the emerging sector of people, farmers saying, I would like to know who eats my food, and consumers saying, I want to know where my food comes from, I want a trusted source, I want to know the farm family, and really have a relationship with them and not simply buying off the shelf. Yet direct farm sales are 0.2% of the total sales of the county. 0.2%, that's one half the national average. So there's, again, a lot of opportunity here in Story County. And again, it's a sign of how distant we are, our farms have become from feeding human beings, that only 0.4% nationally of the foods farmers sell are sold directly to consumers. With that in mind, I'd like to show you the last 40 years of crop production and livestock production in Story County using data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which has these wonderful data sets showing personal income in all industries, but very detailed data in farming especially. And I can go back quite a ways to show you some of the trends. The orange line on that wall shows all of the income earned by all of the 1,000 farms in the county selling all the crops and the livestock that they sell. And you see it's a substantial rise from $50 million of sales in 1969 to $250 million, a five-fold increase in 40 years. Dramatic growth in those markets. You also notice that a lot of that growth was actually in the last 2 years, due to a speculative bubble in the grain industry where grain traders are bidding the price of grain up, and that bubble has burst. So these figures will not look nearly as good next year. This is not constant dollar. I'll show you constant dollar very soon now. The maroon line shows how much it's cost to produce those products. And you see that it's actually rising along a very similar curve. And especially in the last couple of years when prices went up, the input dealers found a way to raise their prices too, although in this case not quite as fast as the market was rising for the farmers. The red line shows the cost subtracted from the cash income. That's what I call the farm production balance, or what an economist might call net farm cash income. And you see that's basically been holding very steady through the whole life of this chart for 40 years, with the exception of the last couple of years with a speculative grain bubble, rose income substantially. So some good news there, steady growth over time, a little rise in the last few years, but not a lot of real sign of agriculture growing as a sector over the last 40 years in terms of its financial clout or its ability to build wealth that stays home. But as the gentleman mentioned, this is only one way of looking at that data, because I find it very instructive to adjust this for inflation, because the value of the dollar today is one-fifth what it was when this chart was started in 1969. So to get that data, I adjust this for the cost of living. And actually, very different patterns emerge from the same data when you do this. The first thing you notice is that farmers in 1979 started reducing their real cost of farming very steadily until the last 2 years. And this is a sign of extremely good management by farmers who are facing, in some ways, a hostile climate to sell into. And they're finding ways to reduce costs, reduce their margins. This unfortunately also reflects farmers leaving the industry and going into other businesses. But good management, good cost savings, and basically sort of, steadily declining sales for farm products. When you adjust for inflation, though, you see that in 1973-74, farmers earned a surplus of $140 million in 1 year farming. And that's about 10 times what we're earning right now, and that was in 1 year. Does anybody know why farmers did so well in 1973 and 74? Okay, well, that's part of the answer. In 1973, the OPEC, oil-producing countries, restricted the production of oil, which forced the price up to what we thought was the unbelievably high value of $40 a barrel in current dollars. And we were having a panic about oil in this country. We had people standing in line 2 hours at a gas station wondering if they could get enough gas to get to work or to take a vacation to see grandmother. But the other thing that happened was we were buying so much oil from abroad, from the Middle East, with dollars that we were actually losing some of our dollar supply. And the folks in the White House sat down and said, strategically, we have to do something about this. And they came up with what looked like a very good win-win-win situation. They said, let's have farmers sell more grain to Russia, because Russia has had some crop failures, they had some distribution breakdowns, and they have bank accounts in dollars. So if we can sell them grain, we'll get our dollars back, they'll get food, our farmers will make more money. It sounded like a sort of nice thing all around. The only dilemma was that Russia spent 2 years buying wheat and corn from us, and in 74 called us up and said, we have enough, we don't need yours anymore. And suddenly now we had farmers who had ramped up their production. You may remember Secretary Earl Butz getting on the TV and saying, plant fence row to fence row. Get big or get out of agriculture. If you don't get big, you won't be competitive because we're going to find you permanent export markets abroad. And if you don't ramp up production to meet those, you'll be left behind. I was a journalist in the 80s talking to farmers who went to lenders in 1974 asking for money. And they said, we need $250,000 to improve our farm. And the lender said, I'll give you $400,000, but not a penny less. Because if you don't get big, and you will not be competitive. So what happened was farmers took on debt under pressure from federal and private lenders that they could pay off if the prices had stayed high, but they couldn't pay off when the prices fell. When Russia stops buying grain, we have piles of corn, probably had a big pile somewhere near Nevada of corn that nobody could sell right away on the streets. It was all over the Midwest. And when you have piles of corn you can't sell, guess what? The price goes down. And when nobody's buying that grain, the price goes down even further. So in 1975, basically farm income went to the same level it was in 72, with one critical difference. Farmers had taken on new debts. They could not pay at the prevailing rates of grain. So those 2 years led directly to what we now would call the farm credit crisis of the 1980s, when farmers realized they had taken on debts they could not pay back and asked lenders to give them 15 or 20% of their debt written off so that farmers could cash flow and their farms would not be foreclosed. Does that remind you of any crisis we've been struggling with lately? It's essentially the same crisis, and one of the signs of how distant we are from farmers is we forgot the farm story we all knew when we got into the housing and derivative market. If we kept our memory intact, we'd be in better shape. Yes? Well, I mean, I think you could, it certainly was argued at the time that it was a bait and switch in a sense, especially when you had the Farmers Home Administration, which was the lender of last resort, saying to farmers, you have to take on debts to be competitive. And knowing that those farmers were vulnerable and that they might have trouble if the price were to go down, it's really, and that is identical, actually, with the way lenders have gone to low-income families and said, you can buy houses now, even though you don't have a down payment, because we need the cash flow. And I think that is a bait and switch in a very real way. Well, we could say that. Yes. My point for today, I mean, we can talk about that. I love talking about it, but I'll sort of move on just to kind of, you know, get forward here. The two good years you can point to where wealth was really made for the region led to further decline. And that means that even after adjusting for inflation, there's not a lot of positive news in the story. There's a speculative bubble here. There's a speculative bubble here. They both break. And we're left with kind of an overall decline in the commodity economy. Again, these farmers in this county in Iowa have doubled productivity in the last 40 years. Farmers have been incredibly good at milking high production out of limited resources. But someone else gets a reward for that production. So even if you're looking at this 98% of the market that's sort of commodity production, it's not all that healthy, and we ought to think about how to reward commodity producers better. We ought to make sure that their interests are protected, but also none of that is feeding our county very directly. All in all, producers in this county earned $13 million more in 2008 than they did in 1969, only $13 million more after doubling productivity. Yet it's still a $450 million net gain to the county from agriculture since 1979. Some very real resources that have come into the area and that helps you fend to the economy in the last 30 years. To say the same thing in words, on average since 1979, county farmers have sold $195 million of crops and livestock, but it's cost them $180 million each year to raise them, a net surplus each year of $15 million. Better than many of the regions I've studied. After subsidies, one of every four farms reported a net loss to the farm census in 2007. Again, this is better than many places I have studied, but still it's of some concern when agriculture is such a key industry to have one of every four farms operating apparently at a loss. It doesn't suggest the stability and the structure you'd like to have in a solid core farm area. If we take the orange line I showed before and break that into income from crops in the green line and income from livestock on the maroon line, you see something very essential here. crop income has really gone up and down a lot, but it's really not any higher today than it was in 1969. It's pretty much been a wash. Farmers are selling as much grain in real dollars as they did 40 years ago. What's really changed in Story County is the ability to make wealth by raising livestock. This is a sign of both decreasing margins for raising cattle, raising hogs, making milk. It's a sign of people getting out of the business because returns just were not there and they went and did something else. It's also a sign that those animals have essentially moved to bigger feedlots elsewhere as that had the money to really command that production in a faraway place. If you want a strong food economy in Story County, one of the first things to think about is how to reward livestock producers for the work they do, harnessing a natural process of increase so that they actually can get financial return for stewarding that process. This compares some of the federal payments coming into the county. The orange line shows the federal farm payments that go to farmers, an average of $17 million a year, as shown in that dotted line. And the blue line shows SNAP coupons, or food stamps, coming into low-income people in the county. You'll notice that over time, the number of people collecting food stamps has been rising fairly steadily in real dollars, while the amount of federal subsidies has been kind of hovering rather steady. You might expect, after 40 years of paying farm subsidies, that we would need less food stamps, but that's just the opposite happening. The more money we spend supporting farmers, the more we have to support consumers to buy food at a fair price. And also, I think I hear some rural people being concerned about the welfare recipients who depend on food stamps for their income to buy food, and this kind of shows the balance of where those federal payments are coming in to this county. This next chart is very complicated, and I'm not going to dwell on it in great detail, but I wanted to say this is the maroon line from the previous chart, the expenses that farmers take on, broken into the components. And what you see very quickly is the number one expense for farmers in Story County is chemicals, fertilizer, and lime, a total of $40 million each year being spent on the chemicals needed to raise the crops that are being raised. And a big bump in that in the last 3 years that follows the speculative grain bubble we had. The yellow line shows you that feed costs have been declining up until recent years as people got out of the industry. The purple line shows that the number of livestock purchases have been declining as people got out of the industry. What I really want to focus on now is not so much the specific lines, but to ask really, how many of the chemicals that farmers buy are sourced in Story County? Any? Very little, I think. How much of the oil, the orange line, is sourced in Story County? Almost none. How about the the feed. Increasingly, people are buying feed from prepackaged mixes that come in by semi-load. Increasing animals may be coming in from far away looking for the best genetics. And in that way, what worries me about this chart is that a lot of the essentials that farmers need to produce their crops and livestock are not sourced here, so that constitutes a flow of money away from Story County as farmers farm. I very cautiously estimate, and I hope I'm lowballing this number considerably, that $80 million of farm inputs are bought each year by county farmers in the course of making about a $15 million surplus. So actually, the act of farming creates a little bit of cash flow in, but a lot of cash flow out. And it's of some concern to the future of Story County to see those resources coming in and then leaving so rapidly. One way to repatriate those dollars would be to think more about local inputs, to create fertility here. This is an example in Milwaukee of a inner city kids raising earthworms to create commercial scale fertilizer for Wisconsin farms. It produces fertility. It's made right in the community. The money cycles there, the expertise cycles there, and it's actually a product you can produce instead of being dependent on oil or some distant manufacturer. Other ways would be to focus more on organic production, to produce compost on an even larger scale, to have really mass scale fertility being developed, using food waste from cities, from institutions, and so on. Produce more green energy so that more of the energy that you're actually using for fueling tractors or cooling buildings comes from farms here in the region. Reduce the scale of technology so that more of the tools are actually purchased here from local manufacturers so that money stays home and there are people who know how to repair your tool because they help build it. These are just some simple ways, there's a lot of other ways we could think of to really keep those dollars from flowing away from Story County. But now let's look at the fact that people eat three times a day if they're able to, and that creates some economic value in its own right. The market for food in Story County is $214 million each year. And that's how much at a retail level it costs to feed the entire population. Unfortunately, again, in farm country, about 90% of that is being bought from sourced outside of Story County. So this constitutes a flow of $190 million leaving the county each year as people living next to farmers go outside the area to buy their food. Here are the markets for food at home. And these are humble, but I think very substantial markets. And when I show charts like this to farmers and say, who thinks the $27 million market for meat is worth going after, there's usually a little bit of thoughtful nodding in the back of the room. If consumers in this county bought only 15% of their food directly from farms without an intermediary, it would produce $19 million of new farm income each year. That's more than the surplus made by the farms right now each year. It's by no means a trivial act, and I don't think eating 15% of your food from your own county in farm country is an unreasonable goal for us to head for. The good news, I guess, in this story is if you go back to the chart I showed you before, the consumer market for food in this region is almost identical to the market that farmers are selling to on the global commodity market. So farmers have a real choice to make. Would you rather sell to a global market that has shown a lot of inconsistency in the last 40 years, really doesn't care if your farm survives as long as the commodities are delivered to their door, or would you rather sell to neighbors who might value having a farm down the road to help pay for taxes, to help educate their school kids, to be a place to visit, to sort of have a farmer in the fabric of life and the skills about food in part of your texture community? Which would you rather do, and how do you want to balance your markets? Is a question that you and other people in the county get to address in your planning process the next several decades. To summarize my story of Story County, $15 million gained by farmers producing crops and livestock, yet $60 million shipped outside in the course of doing that, while consumers buy $190 million or more of food sourced outside of the county. A total flow of money away from Story County of $235 million each year, more than the value of all the farm products currently produced by all the farms in the county. So certainly not a trivial loss, and certainly something to think of if you'd like a future for agriculture here in Story County. I want to step out of the county and go to a national set of data for a while, just to show you how this compares with the United States as a whole. This is the same chart, and for this one, I think I should go all the way back to 1929. And if you looked only within the area bracketed by those arrows, you'd get pretty much the same chart that I showed you for Story County. And you notice that some of the patterns in production nationally are identical to the patterns we saw in Story County, except the numbers are much bigger. U.S. farmers are earning $50 billion less now than they did in 1969 nationally. We like to rave about 2008. It was the best year we've had since 1974, and it was. But look how much worse it was than 1974. And once now the speculative bubble has burst, farm income went down to zero in 2009 nationally. This is net cash income. Notice that the best year we've had since 1974 and 2008 was worse than we had in 1929 after 9 years of a farm depression in this country. Notice that the current level of 2009 resembles more 1932 in the middle of the Great Depression. And yet we have people raving about how the future of agriculture could not be more positive, and we just have to keep going and get to some better place. Yes? This is adjusted for cost of living, and this does not include the subsidy programs. This is just a basic kind of backward economy, producing crops and livestock and what you sell those for in the market. But I think the main story would be there's some scary news out there nationally. It doesn't look good for the entire commodity industry. And if you believe in eating here, we should really think about how to take all this in and rework it. The next chart I'm going to show you is actually a map of the United States with this data for every county in the country. And if farmers are better off now than they were in 1969, you'll see a light green or a dark green county. If they're worse off, you will see yellow or, in bad cases, red. And that is the map. What you very quickly see is that in 6 of every 7 counties in the United States, farmers are worse off today than they were in 1969. And where are the biggest, most sustained patterns of loss? Right in the corn and bean belt where we live. It's really quite stunning. Arguably, the most productive agriculture in the world is creating some of the biggest losses. Pot County's on there now, too, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's very interesting, but I want to focus today on let's look at the green counties. This is a big feedlot operation in North Carolina, big feedlots in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, feedlots in Darien, Idaho. The places that are increasing the most are places where there's almost no agriculture in 1969, and somebody plopped down a big feedlot or big animal facility that took animals away from the Midwest and put them into Idaho or Colorado. That's progress in American agriculture, is stealing cattle from one place and putting them somewhere else. That's not economic development, that's theft. And yet that is the only real sustained pattern you can see of growth in agriculture in this country. The states that have the most increase in agriculture in the United States in this time, Florida, Idaho, Alaska, Hawaii, and Arizona. The rest of the states that are the big farm states are the ones experiencing the biggest losses. Something else happened in 1973. We had piles of corn that we could not sell because Russia decided not to buy it from us. We had just developed a new enzyme process that made it very cheap to make high fructose corn sweetener. And suddenly production starts skyrocketing in 1974, becoming by far and away the most favored sweetener in the food processing industry. Guess what happens the same year? The number of overweight kids in our school starts rising. And nutritionists and dietitians I work with say this is in fact the causal relationship, because when I have sugar, I have an enzyme in my body that says, stop, you've had enough. When I have high fructose corn sweetener, I have no such biological signal. It's very easy to keep eating. And in this way, you can connect overweight kids and nutrition problems in inner city Des Moines directly to the energy crisis of 1973. That's how complicated our food system has become and why we have to be so careful to move forward in ways that we really have some power over so we get the right outcomes. A few more scary facts nationally. Over half of the public school students in the country qualify for free and reduced lunch in a country that prides itself on feeding the world. We lose 5,000 people a year to food poisoning, according to the Centers for Disease Control. The medical costs of obesity are $174 billion per year, which is one half of the value of all the products sold by all the farms in this country each year. It's a remarkable tax we pay to the medical industry for the bad outcomes of an inadequate and imbalanced diet, and bad exercise and bad lifestyles too. On an economic level, one of the threads I think is important is that we often have people talk about a supply chain or a value chain where the producers over here on one end producing raw materials for processing, and the processors and distributors add value to that and ship it out to our stores and our restaurants and our colleges. And the consumer pays a little bit more on the far end, but gets the convenience of something that's prepackaged, ready to go, ready to zap in the microwave, what have you. And that's a good thing in some ways, and this is a very good model if you want to calculate how much value is added at each stage of that process. Unfortunately, what you notice right away is the producer and the consumer are never talking to each other. So they have no way of balancing supply and demand. They cannot balance because there's no conversation. And in fact, the producers respond to signals from processors, and the consumers respond to signals from retailers who are trying to sell them the next latest exotic product. To me, this is a thing that breaks down the connection we need to have between producers and consumers. But even more than that, producers have real risks of climate, of uncertainty, of hailstorm, weather, climate change, what have you, that no one else in the chain faces. So they're actually in a very disadvantaged position in this chain. And consumers have some varying needs in terms of diet and so on. The people in the middle get a reliable stream of commodities that are inert enough that they can store them for a while, they can process them at their leisure, more or less, and create food products that we will buy. The value in the system is basically sucked up by the people in the middle at the expense of those on either end. And that's even shown with some federal data, what the USDA calls the marketing bill. You'll notice the orange area shows what farmers have made since 1950. They're making no more money now than they were in 1950, but then it was 41% of the retail value of food. Now it's only 20% of the retail value of food. The maroon area shows here what the processors have earned in terms of income in that time, from 60% of what was made in the food system to now 80% taken into the processing sector. Economically, this is one of the vehicles taking wealth out of our communities and into the hands of processors and also financiers. I prefer a term I call a value network, where the consumer is actually saying, I'm not looking for this the cheapest possible price. I'm looking for a relationship with a producer. I'm looking to pay perhaps a little bit more for high quality. I want to share the risk the producer faces. So if the producer has risk of climate, I'm going to help maybe by investing in a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Farm, on the front end to help mediate that risk. Or maybe I'll go work and weeding in June to help pull the weeds out of the yard so that crop will come back good to me in the fall. Or maybe I invest in a cooperative store like Wheatfield, or I invest in a meat processing plant where I actually have a relationship with the people that I depend on for food, and I know that they're working for me because I'm part owner, and that we have a conversation about what I need to have in that system. Each of these arrows in this diagram represents flows of money, of connection, and of capacity that get to stay and build, reinforce each other in the community. This is a very much more of a community empowerment model than the value chain idea. And I think we have to move to that. And in fact, in the examples I'm about to show, I think you'll see that starting to form all over the country. Okay, now the happy news. And I'll race through this and we'll have some time for questions and answers when that's over. The blue counties here are all the places in the United States where the hunger that people have to connect between farmer and consumer are the strongest. The blue counties are where direct food sales between farm and consumer are rising the most, from 97 to 2002. New England, Minnesota to Chicago, Pacific Northwest, California, a little bit around Denver and Boulder. These are the highlighted areas, and some here and there scattered around Iowa as well, of course. One of the things that makes me think I can eat in Minnesota in the wintertime, I understand that you have a farm in Nevada that has a greenhouse like this too, a winter CSA farm in western Minnesota called Garden Goddess Greenhouse. They sell fresh greens from November to April, only within 30 miles of their farm. They wanted to build this greenhouse. It's a very intensely solar-heated greenhouse. They took the plans to a banker and said, I don't understand that, I'm not going to loan you money. They went to a credit union and said, sure, we'll give you a loan, and in 6.5 years they had it all paid off. They're producing in this environment. I visited when it was 13 below zero on a cold January day in Minnesota, and I was literally almost being blown over as I was walking from the car to the greenhouse. And I got inside, it was 65 degrees inside. They told me it had been 85 at 3 o'clock, but they had to open the door for a while so it wouldn't be too hot for me. Home Depot gutters filled with organic growing soil. They said, we want stuff off the shelf that anyone can buy, nothing fancy here. Plexiglass heats the sunlight. The sunlight is collected here, blown by a fan down below the soil into a sand and gravel pit that basically is there to retain heat overnight. As the heat rises, it helps heat the soil, heat the plants when the temperature turns cold. If it should fall below 45 degrees, this propane heater kicks in. They're spending $75 a year heating this greenhouse with propane heat. The rest is all free from the sun once they've paid off the mortgage on the greenhouse. And the plants look really happy. They're thriving and glistening in this environment. I was in Japan in 1989 and saw greenhouses scattered around the countryside. There's no reason we shouldn't be having facilities all over the country so we can have really good fresh foods in all of our metro areas across the U.S. A lot of you know Kamiran Shine in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He's been working for about 12 years now helping connect local farmers with local buyers. He's sharing his most recent data now. This is a chart showing how much sales have increased from $100,000 of sales in 1998 to $2.6 million of sales 12 years later. The technology here is very complicated. It involves Kamiar sitting down with a farmer and saying, wouldn't you like to sell to a local buyer? And sitting down with local restaurants and colleges and saying, wouldn't you like to buy food from local farms? And they say, sure. And they figure out how to do it. After many, many years of setting up relationships, that's starting to take off. really got a boost when Hanson's Farm Fresh Dairy in Waterloo kicked in and started putting all this locally produced milk into the market. David Swenson, an economist here at Iowa State, calculated a few years ago that if residents of this 8 county were to eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day that could be grown in Iowa, such as apples or carrots, for only the 3 months when they were in season, it would produce this many jobs and $6 million of labor income. This compares very favorably with factories that counties are dangling incentives in front of to try to source, and they have a discussion and then turn away and go somewhere else because the deal is better. As my friend Wayne Roberts says from Toronto, you cannot outsource a local food economy. The investments you make in creating this infrastructure really tend to stay home and tend to stay at work in Story County itself. Many of you have met or have seen Will Allen from Growing Power in Milwaukee, a former professional basketball player who grew up near Milwaukee on a farm. He owns 5 farms in the area. When he came back from basketball playing, he bought this greenhouse because he saw it as a place to train inner-city kids about food and ecology. They raise earthworms, as I mentioned. They dry and pelletize the earthworm castings into a fertilizer product that's spread on fields commercially by farmers in Wisconsin. They also learn about cycles of life, feeding fish inside this blue tank, who eat the green plants in there. The manure from the fish goes in the water, gets poured on the plants to the left. Inner city kids learning the cycles of ecology by making a livelihood selling $200,000 worth of food products through a CSA, farmers market stand, and to restaurants directly. A small start. We have a long way to go to feed everybody, but this is the foundation on which that work can happen. I visited Greensboro Garden in Philadelphia. This is a Mary Seton Carboy and her husband ran a restaurant in New Jersey about 25 years ago, and they were making a good living, but they said, you know, this is nice, but we want to do something for the city because it looks really depressing in there. They went to a neighborhood that I actually tried to student teach in when I was in college, and the teacher I worked for was a science teacher. He carried a baseball bat with him all the times during the school day because it was a fairly rough school, and he didn't have to use his bat, but he wanted to remind the kids that he had the power. They found a 1-acre piece of ground that a factory had been on that had pollution on it. They went to the city and said, can we rent your acre of ground to farm? And they said, you want to do something in the center city of Philadelphia? Sure, you can have it for $1 for 99 years. They built cement containers on top of the pollution to keep their soil from the pollution. They put in organic topsoil. They built in hydroponic tables that are about 4 feet off the ground so that the nutrients can roam through the roots of the plants, staying free from the brown fields below. On this farm of 1 acre in Central City, Philadelphia, they're selling $650,000 worth of product each year. It's not all their own product, but being restaurateurs and having 30 restaurants close by, they sell food to 30 restaurants that can come to their farm to pick up products from 75 farms in New Jersey and Philadelphia. This is their cold storage unit. It's an USDA plan, wood frame, fiberglass insulation, an air conditioner, jimmied with so it stays on most of the time, keeping the temperature at 37 degrees year-round, even when the temperature is 110 and sticky in downtown Philadelphia. This is not expensive, but it's safe, and it secures food from 75 farms to 30 restaurants, total sales $650,000 on a 1-acre piece of ground, and a very attractive place to gather in the fall to buy your pumpkins and mums. One of my favorite stories right now is from Burlington, Vermont. I was out there in January. The school food service there has 50% free and reduced lunch in their school, 72 different languages being spoken in the school every day as the first language, and they believe that some of the meals that their kids eat are the only meal those folks get every day. Despite those limitations, Doug Davis has a very supportive administration, and he says, if I can't get money from the school board to run my program, I can earn it in another way. He's buying food from 21 local farms in Burlington, Vermont. His latest venture this last year was he went to a baker who makes really high-quality loaves of bread, and he said, I would like to have your bread in every sandwich I serve in my school. How much would it cost to do that? The baker, being very pragmatic, said, well, how many loaves do you want and how much do you pay for them? And when Doug told him how much he was paying for bread, the guy said, I can't meet that price. I have higher quality ingredients. I'm doing craft work. I can't do it for that price. But the baker went back to work for 2 weeks, and he called Doug a little while later, and he said, "You know, I've been thinking about this. If you could find a way to buy 2,000 more loaves of bread each year, I could meet the price you're currently paying." Doug and Bobby at the food service said, "Well, we have 800 staff. If we get 100 of them to buy one loaf of bread each for 20 weeks during the school year, we have 2,000 more loaves of bread." And their staff has said, "Sure, we'll do that." So they have what they call community-supported bread, where the school staff pay $4 a loaf for high-quality bread delivered to them every day or every week at the school cafeteria. They don't have to drive to a bakery. It's cheaper than buying it from the bakery retail, which is 50 miles away. Some of the staff take it to their classrooms to show kids what real bread looks like. Some take it home and eat it. The school makes profit from that exchange, which they use to buy loaves of bread at $2 a loaf for the school sandwiches that they run to serve all the students. They also use some of that profit to buy 2 panini grills because they realize that this same baker has day-old bread every day he cannot sell that they can get for almost nothing. They have a creamery supplying local cheese, so they make grilled cheese sandwiches on artisan bread for no additional money from what they were spending before. And it's this kind of incredible effort to be clever and to be supportive and to build new connections around food that gives me the most hope for the future. Because if we can think about these things and do these things that are cheap and better, we actually have a real solid chance for a future, but also doing some amazing community building around our needs to eat 3 times a day. A couple more stories. Southwest Wisconsin, the town of Viroqua, which is in the beautiful Driftless area south of La Crosse. Last year, a factory shut down overnight. It was a printing and packaging factory for a national firm. And this had 85 of the best jobs in town. It was the best paying job, the largest single factory. And the local economic development authority had been supporting it for years, trying to help it be a good business. But the bean counters in another state said, "We can put all our printing in one shop in Indiana, and it will be cheaper and more efficient for us." So they closed the plant down, and here it is, built in 1974, pretty good condition. The Economic Development Administrator calls up the CEO of the factory and says, "What are you going to do for us now that you've taken 85 of our best jobs out of our town?" And the CEO was somewhat flabbergasted. He didn't expect this question, and he kind of stumbled and rambled and said a few meaningless things for 20 minutes. But she wore him down finally, and he finally turned to her and said, "So what would you like me to do?" And she said, "Sell us the factory." And he ultimately decided to do just that. So they bought the factory. They now own 100,000 square foot building, certified clean enough for food. They're going to make a regional food processing center out of that building. They paid a very trivial amount of money for that factory. It's in their hands, free and clear. They also have 2 existing produce distributors, one of whom wants to really expand dramatically to meet Minneapolis, Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison demand. The other one is working very closely with Amish farmers and wants to expand into those markets, but in a much more kind of slow Amish community-based way. The 2 of them are working together in the same space with the same facilities. A processor that wants to make gluten for food manufacturers, another one that wants to make gluten-free products. So they're going to figure out how to do that in one building. A baker that says, "I will bake bread in my ovens. I will have a little place for people to sit down and eat scones and have coffee together." When we're not in the bakery, that is public space for public meetings. So they create a meeting space as well as a bakery. Nonprofits and some other businesses to be decided will be located in there. Probably some beverage manufacturers, and there's a great sauerkraut producer in this region that might want to get some space too. Yet it's also networked in with a hospital that's committed itself to 10% of its food coming from this food processing center in 2010. Six local schools have made the same promise. An existing food cooperative that says, "We'll bring our network of contacts and farmers into the center so that it'll become a community resource that we can all benefit from." A nearby multi-million-dollar organic farm with a huge root cellar space saying, "You can store your products in our root cellar until you decide if you're going to build your own later." Organic Valley is 20 miles away, offering to help with setting up the cooperative, offering to help with, you know, whatever way they can do to make this a stronger regional activity. I could actually spell the word Amish, but the computer again kind of smushed my letters together. The Amish farmers are trying to sell to this second distributor. You see the value network forming around a single building and how this one resource really creates the kind of promise that we've been talking about all along that really creates connection capacity and good food for people who live in this area. they also had to think a little further because they said, we have to think of a vehicle for getting this food to people. And we don't want to have the farmers in one co-op fighting with the hospitals and the schools, where the hospitals say, we're going to lower the price every year, and the farmers are going to try to keep the price up. So they said, we see a model in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where a hospital helps set up a producers and buyers co-op, where everybody sits on the same board. The trucker's there, the distributor's there, the hospital's there, the farmers are there. And they set up fair prices for the entire system. The theory being that if we can agree on prices that we all can live with, then we all will have any reason, we will have every reason to sustain that pricing system, and it could be much more sustainable for all of us over time. Barocca adopted that model after deciding it was the best one out there. It's a hybrid co-op model. It's been used a lot in Europe, but very seldom in the United States. They passed bylaws on this on Tuesday, so that's underway. Finally, a really innovative cooperative called Home on the Range in Northfield, Minnesota, a Latino co-op where Latinos have had this analysis that basically they end up stuck with the worst jobs at the worst pay that no one else really wants to do, and they have no ownership. So they said, if we're going to be the meat processors of Minnesota, why don't we own those facilities instead of working for low wages for somebody else? So a Guatemalan entrepreneur has started developing a way of doing quarter-acre chicken operations. This is, again, simple wood construction covered with plastic. The chickens can be sheltered indoors if they want to. They can also run outdoors very easily through huge doors.